from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, no guest. Instead, lots of information on health and healing, the environment, public health issues. I'm going to go in depth on why you don't hear more in the mainstream media about what's wrong with genetically modified foods. Well, it's because the biotech industry is gagging scientists around the genetically modified food issue. If you come up with results that show that GMOs are bad, you don't get published. You don't get funded. That's not good. So I'm going to share the latest on that with you. Also, for those of you who've asked, what are my thoughts on cutting back on entitlements like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security? I'm going to deal with one of those today. I'll deal with each one separately on a different day. From Chris Hedges from Truthdig, hijacking of human rights. Many of you know that Chris Hedges, if you listen to this program, resigned from a writers group that champions human rights and freedom of expression. It's called PEN, American Center. And that's because of its new head, Suzanne Nossel, a former State Department official. And after looking carefully at her background and what she supports globalization, she supports the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, she supports NAFTA, she supports the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, she is a super democratic hawk. I believe he was absolutely right. As a result, Richard Gale and I wrote a piece in support of him. Chris Hedges is giving even more details, and it's really interesting. So I'll share that with you. Also, from Ralph Nader, it's time that we started paying closer attention to why they want to deregulate everything, the corporations. How are they doing it, and how does it impact us? Also, top scientists to Obama ban mutation experiments that will make the avian flu more infectious. That is nowhere in the media. I'll share that with you. And things you should know about America's little Guantanamo, Will Potter. Let's begin. I watched around the countries I go to how people eat, what they eat, and kind of the mood that you see. What I don't see is when people sit that everyone's on, let's say in Spain, that everyone's on a cell phone or they're Twittering. I don't see people parking a fast food meal or frozen dinner if they've warmed up in front of a TV. I see them taking their time, expressing the joy of that day or the issues or problems of that day and reflecting on it with different input. They take their time. It's called slow eating. In fact, there's a whole movement in the United States now called the slow eating movement. And I just wish there were slow eating natural food restaurants. More often than not, the natural food restaurants, and especially we're at the epicenter right here on the Upper West Side. We're at 83rd and Broadway where our office is in studios. Within 6 blocks, there are 6 vegan or vegetarian restaurants. But more often than not, it's mainly younger people and quick meals and lots of conversation and little attention to the actual food. And when you sit and watch, having owned 4 restaurants, you want people to really appreciate the ambiance, the music, the quality of the food, and be able to relax doing it. This is the latest from the University of Rhode Island on this subject. Researchers at the University of Rhode Island have found that eating faster increases the amount of food consumption. Results of 2 new studies reveal that men eat significantly faster than women. Heavier people eat faster than slimmer people. And refined grains are consumed faster than whole grains, among other findings. So what this is saying is this. that if you eat slow, you're going to lose weight, be healthier, and feel better. And also, I believe we should go one step further. I believe that we should be learning how to make foods healthy, but also how to make foods exciting. And to that end, starting in about a week or two, I'll be inviting a small number of people, probably no more than about 5 to 6 at a time, to learn gourmet, vegan, and raw food preparation from my daughter, Shelley. It'll be free. It's just, I thought of it yesterday. Wouldn't it be nice if people really cared about food, knew how to make great dishes? Like, she made some biscotti yesterday that was just phenomenal. It was perfection. And yet, all natural, gluten-free, sugar-free. And think of the things that you don't make yourself because you assume you couldn't, like those dried kale chips. You can make anything you want. So I'm going to expand the concept. And then later, probably in June, I'm going to go to my home and work from there for the summer. And I'll hook up an internet feed and do some daily classes on juicing, food prep, drying, mixing, seasoning, marinating, the things that could allow you to have a much better experience with food. But after you make it, you don't want to rush through it. You want to take your time and savor it. And in and of itself, that's a whole art. You have to slow down and appreciate it. But when you make food, you're more likely to eat it slowly and appreciate it. Antioxidants could control Alzheimer's. This is according to a professor, Department of Pharmacology, Physiology, and Therapeutics, University of North Dakota School of Medicine. And it was published in the journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Let me quote this. It says, "There is presently no treatment that alters the course of Alzheimer's disease. However, an increasing amount of evidence suggests that changes in the way the body handles iron and other metals like copper and zinc may start years before the onset of Alzheimer's symptoms. A new study showed that reducing iron levels in blood plasma may protect the brain from changes related to Alzheimer's." That's good that they're doing it, and it's good that they're looking at antioxidants. But they're wrong when they say, quote, "there is presently no treatment that alters the course of Alzheimer's." Well, I've altered it several times. In fact, I've reversed it once, and that person's still alive and mentally functioning. This person's gone through a lot of being in an accident and having a lot of other problems, but the brain is functioning magnificently. And to make this point, I did a whole study with individuals who had brain inflammation-related disorders, including Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, memory loss. In fact, just recently, I just spoke with a father, an 86-year-old gentleman, late last night, to ask him how his son's doing. His son is 62, named Don. And he said he just thinks it's just remarkable. Now, the father's an engineer, and he's a kind of a laid-back, critical-thinking person. When there was an when the father decided that he had to help the son because the son had such bad short-term memory loss, he couldn't work, he couldn't get anything done. He just kept repeating the same thing over and over and again, which is very common in short-term memory loss. Just understand, behind that short-term memory loss is dementia. Behind that is more often than not Alzheimer's. And behind all that is inflammation. So when he called my office and said, would I be able to help his son? I worked on a protocol. I gave the son the protocol. 6 weeks later, the short-term memory loss is gone. It's been reversed. That doesn't mean that he's cured. It just means that with the kind of protocol to impact the short-term memory required a rather vigorous setting. So he had to be in a setting where he was helped by someone 24 hours a day because he would forget things on his own. And sometimes people don't realize, what's the danger of having short-term memory loss? Well, how about going to bed at night and forgetting that you have food that you're cooking on the stove? that's a reality. That actually had happened three times to this guy in Los Angeles, and he's lucky he didn't burn down the building. That's one of the reasons they decided to have an intervention. In any case, I took an autism person who had reversed autism with the protocol I gave him, dementia and Alzheimer's, to a group in Washington, D.C. of scientists from around the world, anti-aging scientists and physicians. And I just had them tell their story. Came out on stage, thousands and thousands of people there, and they just talked about what it meant to be where they were that day. Then they walked outside and they went into the corridor. And within minutes, hundreds and hundreds, the whole corridor was packed. Everybody wanted to know what happened. And I explained that if anyone wanted to come to my office in New York, I'd be happy to share information on protocols. To this date, not a single person from any of the scientific conferences I've attended have called, followed up, asked for the protocols. So there's a big difference between us believing there is no benefit right now versus the benefit that's out there. But this is also part of the larger extent, the problem when we believe all of our truths must come from one source, an official source. So if the National Institutes of Mental Health said, "Eureka, we have a way of reversing or improving Alzheimer's," it would make headline news, because they're an official source and are never challenged or questioned. If the New York Times reported on it, it becomes news. If a holistic physician, nurse, or any other practitioner or myself does it, it's a non-event. So at least they're getting into the field a little bit. Next up, red wine, a vital weapon against obesity. This is research from Purdue University. And they found a compound in red wine that's able to block cellular processes that facilitate fat cells to develop, thus opening the door to a potential method for controlling obesity. And the compound is called picetanol, P-I-C-E-A-T-A-N-N-O-L. It's similar in structure to resveratrol, the compound that we've spoken about so much on this program that helps fight heart disease and neurodegenerative diseases and cancer. And resveratrol is actually converted into picetanol in humans after it's consumed. Quote, picetanol actually alters the timing of gene expressions, gene functions, and insulin action during the process in which early-stage fat cells become mature fat cells. So that's good. So why not just take more resveratrol? That would make sense. That's good. And also ancient saffron. You probably have not paid attention because it's so small. It's so lightweight. It's the most expensive herb in the world. You get little tiny fibers of it. They're so thin. They're thinner than fishing line. And yet, it's very powerful. It costs about $1,000 a pound. It's expensive. And according to Green Med Info, quote, clearly there's something magical about the Crocus sativus flower, which gives us the spice saffron. If it's strikingly beautiful, it is also strikingly beneficial. And then it goes on to talk about what it does. It's been used in the Greek Isles of the Aegean. It's perhaps even more amazing is the fact that 50,000 years ago, depictions of prehistoric places in the northwest Iran contained saffron-based pigments indicating the human relationship with saffron. So, what does saffron do? Well, it's good for Alzheimer's disease. It's also good for a depression. It helps you if you have cardiac hypertrophy, diabetic neuropathy, hypertension, middle cerebral artery occlusion, pancreatic cancer, and wound healing. So, multiple sclerosis, inflammation, liver cancer, erectile dysfunction, colorectal cancer, chemotherapy-induced liver toxicity, anxiety disorders, opiate addiction withdrawal, it helps you, respiratory disease, and psoriasis. How about that? But I would also know from my own experience of using it and helping people that it's good as a broncho conditioner. It is neuroprotective. It is a sedative. It's an aphrodisiac. It's anti-mutagenic. And it's a great antioxidant. So, nice to have that. All in saffron. So, saffron is the one that we want to use today. And hawthorn berries. Hawthorn historically has always been known in any culture that uses it as a heart tonic. And indeed, the latest research shows that it is. Hawthorn berries have been used for heart disorders. It's a brownish, wrinkled false fruit of the hawthorn tree. It is loaded with antioxidants. It improves circulation. It improves lowering of blood pressure. It improves cardiac arrhythmias. It gets rid of the arrhythmias. And it helps chronic heart failure. It reduces inflammation. It protects the stomach lining of, in times of stress. And it's a strong antibacterial. So, University of Maryland Medical Center states that the antioxidants found in hawthorn berries are responsible for helping cardiac, respiratory, and circulatory conditions. They're rich in quercetin, and they're rich in procyanidins. Those are the same antioxidants found in grapes. And so I'm suggesting hawthorn tea or hawthorn capsule each day can make a big difference in helping your heart. Tomorrow I'll talk about sucralose causing cancer and boosting memory with wakeful resting. We have a lot to share. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Tonight at 7 p.m., I believe we're going to have a historic program on the Progressive Commentary Hour, a special hour broadcast to explore the demise of American culture and religion and values and where it might be leading us. I'll be hosting a dialogue with two of America's great intellectuals of conscience, Chris Hedges, award-winning journalist, Pulitzer Prize winner, social and political activist, and we'll be here, and Andrew Harvey, Oxford Fellow, renowned scholar on world mystical religions and a teacher, global activist on environmental and social issues. They've never appeared together, and especially on the issue of the demise of American culture. So that will be a show you will not want to miss. Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to listen in, or you can listen over a telephone anywhere. And by the way, we just set some new record of millions and millions and millions of minutes of people listening, tens of thousands of people. They go to the phone anywhere in North America, including Canada, by calling 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. And you can listen in. Now, I've got two screenings, and that's it, coming up of Seeds of Death. April 30th at 7:30 in Manhattan at 12th Street and 1st Avenue, Theater for the New City. There's only a $5 donation, which goes to the projector guy. And reservations are 212 212-254-1109. 212-254-1109. I've put five different films down there, and they've all been just not even standing room. It's floor sitting room because it's always mobbed. And then Woodstock Community Center, screening of Seeds of Death. I'll be at both with a lecture afterwards and Q&A. Saturday, April 27th, 7 p.m. And this time, call, make a reservation. Last time, 400 people couldn't get in. It was so packed. I was told it was the largest outpouring in the history of Woodstock Community Center. So I went outside and did a lecture outside to a the group that couldn't get inside. Thank goodness I took copies to give everyone as a gift of the film. So they all got a copy outside. But we just stood outside and for 2 hours and went through all this. That number for reservations in Woodstock is 845-697-1025. 845-697-1025. Hey, for all of you in the Natural Living and Running and Walking Club, you came yesterday to our first meeting to start the training. What a great group. And don't forget that tonight, for those of you who were there yesterday, you'll be at a new screening at 7 p.m. tonight of a new film that no one has heard about or seen. It's under wraps. It's going to premiere on a PBS station shortly. So every Monday, I'm going to be showing a different film to the running group. We have a lot of fun. If you want to join the running club, and it's free, it's a public service. About almost 30,000 people we've trained, 25,000 do the marathon. Everyone who started has done it. Just show up at 9 a.m. at 90th and 5th Avenue in Center Park on Sunday. 90th Street and 5th Avenue in Center Park on Sunday. Now, I want to share a commentary from Chris Hedges. It was published in TruthDig.com. He says, the appointment of Suzanne Nossel, a former State Department official and longtime government supporter, as executive director of PEN American Center, is part of a campaign to turn the U.S. human rights organizations into propagandists for preemptive war and apologists for empire. Nossel's appointment led me to resign from PEN, as well as withdraw from speaking at the PEN World Voices Festival in May. But Nossel is only symptomatic of the widespread hijacking of human rights organizations to demonize those, especially Muslims, branded by the state as the enemy, in order to cloak preemptive war and empire with a fictional virtue and to effectively divert attention from our own mounting human rights abuses, including torture, warrantless wiretapping and monitoring, and the denial of due process and extrajudicial assassinations. Nossel, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs under Hillary Clinton in a State Department that was little more than a subsidiary of the Pentagon, is part of the new wave of humanitarian interventionists, in parentheses, such as Samantha Power, Michael Ignatia, and Susan Rice, who naively see in the United States military a vehicle to create a better world. They know little of the reality of war or the actual inner workings of empire. They harbor a childish belief in the innate goodness and ultimate benevolent nature of American power. The deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocents, the horrendous suffering and violent terror inflicted in the name of their utopian goals in Iraq and Afghanistan barely register on their moral calculus. This makes them at once oblivious and dangerous. Innocence is a kind of insanity, Graham Greene wrote in his novel, The Quiet American, and those who destroy to build are impregnably armored by good intentions and ignorance. There are no good wars. There are no just wars. As Erasmus wrote, there is nothing more than wicked, more disastrous, more widely destructive, more deeply tenacious, more loathsome than war. Whoever heard of 100,000 animals rushing towards each other to butcher each other, as men do every day? Erasmus asked. But war, he knew, was very useful to the power elite. War permitted the powerful, in the name of national security and by fostering a culture of fear, to effortlessly strip the citizens of his or her rights. A declaration of war ensures that All the affairs of state are at the mercy of the appetites of a few. There are cases, and Bosnia in the 1990s was one, when force should be employed to halt an active campaign of genocide. This is the lesson of the Holocaust. When you have the capacity to stop genocide and you do not, you are culpable. For this reason, we are culpable in the genocides in Cambodia and Rwanda. But the so-called humanitarian interventionists have twisted this moral imperative to intercede against genocide to justify the calls for preemptive war and imperial expansion. Saddam Hussein did carry out campaigns of genocide against the Kurds and the Shiites. But the dirty fact is that while these campaigns were underway, we provided support to Baghdad or looked the other way. It was only when Washington wanted war and the bodies of tens of thousands of Kurds and Shiites had long decomposed in mass graves that we suddenly began to speak in the exalted language of human rights. These humanitarian interventionists studiously ignore our own acts of genocide, first unleashed against Native Americans, and then exported to the Philippines, and later nations such as Vietnam. They do not acknowledge, even in the light of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, our own capacity for evil. They do not discuss in their books or articles the genocides we backed in Guantanamo and East Timor, or the crime of preemptive war. They minimize the horror and suffering we have delivered to Iraqis and Afghans and exaggerate or fabricate the benefits. The long string of atrocities carried out in the name mocks the idea of the United States as a force for good with the right to impose its values on others. The ugly truth shatters their deification of the U.S. power. And also, in the contentious year she headed Amnesty International USA before leaving in January, oversaw a public campaign by the organization to support NATO war in Afghanistan. She was running Amnesty International USA when the organization posted billboards at bus stops that read, "Human rights for women and girls in Afghanistan. NATO, keep the progress going." Madeleine Albright, along with senior State Department officials and politicians, were invited to speak at Amnesty International's Women Forum during Nossel's tenure. Nossel has urged Democrats to stay the course in Iraq, warning that a failure in Iraq could unleash, quote, a kind of post-Vietnam, post-Mogadishu hangover that would lamentably herald an era of deep reservations among the U.S. public regarding the use of force, end quote. She worked as a State Department official to discredit the Goldstone Report, which charged Israel with war crimes against the Palestinians. As a representative on the UN Human Rights Council, she said that, quote, "the top of our list is our defense of Israel and Israel's right to fair treatment at the Human Rights Council." Not a word about the Palestinians. She has advocated for expanding armed intervention in countries such as Syria and Libya. She has called for a military strike against Iran if it does not halt its nuclear enrichment program. In an article in the Washington Quarterly titled Battle Hymn of the Democrats, she wrote, quote, "Democrats must be seen to be every bit as tough-minded as their opponents. Democratic intervention as a peace party is a political dead end. In a milieu of war or near war, the public will look for leadership that is bold and strident, more forceful, resolute, and pugnacious than would otherwise be tolerated," end quote. In a 2004 Foreign Affairs article, Smart Power Reclaiming Liberal Interventionism, she wrote, quote, "we need to deploy our power in ways that make us stronger, not weaker," end quote. Not a stunning thought, but one that should be anathema to human rights campaigners. She added, quote, "U.S. interests are furthered by enlisting others on behalf of U.S. goals," end quote, which, of course, is what she promptly did at Amnesty International. Her smart power theory calls on the U.S. to exert its will around the globe by employing a variety of means and tactics, using the United Nations and human rights groups, for example, to promote the nation's agenda as well as the more naked and raw coercion of military force. This is not a new original idea, but when held by George Bush, idiocy, I guess it looked thoughtful. The plight of our own dissidents, including Bradley Manning, is, of course, no concern to Nozzle, and apparently of no concern now to Penn. Colleen Rowley and Anne Wright first brought Nossal's past and hawkish ideology to light when she became the executive director of Amnesty International USA a year ago. Rowley and Wright have written correctly that, quote, humanitarian interventionists in and out of government see no distinction between human rights work and the furtherance of U.S. imperial power. Nossal, they noted, sees no conflict between her current role and having been a member of the executive staff while her president and secretary of state bosses were carrying out war crimes such as drone attacks in Pakistan and Afghanistan and shielding torturers and their enablers in the Bush administration from prosecution. Is this the resume of a human rights advocate in the United States? Are human rights organizations supposed to further the agenda of the state rather than defend its victims? Are the ideas of a humanitarian interventionist compatible with human rights? Are writers and artists no longer concerned with the plight of all dissidents, freedom of expression, and the excess of state power? Are we nothing more than the puppets of the elite? Aren't we supposed to be in perpetual voluntary alienation from all forms of power? Isn't power from a human rights perspective the problem? The current business of human rights means human rights for some and not for others. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Physicians for Human Rights, the Peace Alliance, and Citizens for Global Solutions are all guilty of buying into the false creed that the U.S. military force can be deployed to promote human rights. None of these groups stood up to oppose the invasion of Iraq or Afghanistan, as if preemptive war is not only one of the grossest violations of human rights. The creed of humanitarian intervention means for many shedding tears over the right victims. Its supporters lobby for the victims in Darfur and ignore the victims in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and Gaza. They denounce the savagery of the Taliban, but ignore the savagery we employ in our offshore penal colonies or our drone-infested war zones. They decry the enslavement of girls in brothels in India and Thailand, but not the slavery of workers in our own produce fields or our prisons. They demand justice for persecuted dissidents in the Arab world, but say nothing about Bradley Manning. The playwright and fierce anti-war critic Arthur Miller, the first American president of Penn International, fearlessly stood up to McCarthyism and was blacklisted. He denounced the Vietnam War. He decried the invasion of Iraq. Penn, when it embodied Miller's resistance and decency, stood for something real and important. The U.S. bombed Iraq into submission and then invaded. Miller, who called the war a form of mass murder, said indignantly, "It's a joke that the U.S. government wills out the Geneva Convention when they themselves have turned away or flouted so many international treaties." The posing of government shills like Nossal as human rights campaigners and the marginalization of voices like Miller's are part of the sickness of our age. If Penn recaptures the moral thunder of the late Arthur Miller, if it remembers that human rights mean defending all who are vulnerable, persecuted, and unjustly despised, I will be happy to rejoin. All systems of power are the problem, and it is the role of the artist, the writer, the intellectual to defy every center of power on behalf of those whom power would silence and crush. This means, in biblical terms, embracing the stranger. It means being a constant opponent rather than an ally of government. It means being the perpetual outcast. Those who truly fight for human rights understand this. Whether the mask is labeled fascism, democracy, or dictatorship, or of the proletariat, our great adversary remains the apparatus, the bureaucracy, the police, the military. So right, a great person. End of quote, Chris Hedges. Now time for TalkBack, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And I'd like to have your calls, your input. It's time now for you to share your thoughts on a lot of different issues that we discuss here. Back in a moment. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Your turn, we're going to be talking about the issues you find important on our TalkBack segment, 888-874-4888. I said I would mention the entitlements. Well, first, let us be very clear. The United States government does not give you a single penny towards Social Security. You and I and our employers, we take 15% before taxes, and we do it our entire working life. That would mean that just based upon earning $30,000 approximately a year, which is a small amount, and if you were given 5% interest on that, which for decades you would have easily made, that would give you over $900,000 accumulated in your account. First, what happens to all the Social Security money from people who die? Millions and millions of people never get a single amount of that, and a lot of them die in their 60s. Even their late 60s, just when they're beginning to cash their Social Security checks. That means the full amount now goes to whom? The government. So exactly how is my money and your money, we and we alone, contributed that as a savings for our retirement? How is that an entitlement? If the government gave us that money, then it's an entitlement. It didn't give us a penny, not 1 cent. But they've been borrowing against the Social Security Fund and putting in IOUs for a long time. So first, the next time you hear Sean Hannity or one of the people who claim to actually have a brain talk about an entitlement, the entitlements that we should be cutting are not Social Security because, A, it's not an entitlement. The government didn't give you a dime. What is important is to cut the entitlements to big ag, big pharma, big banking, all right? These are the real entitlements because we, the people, bailed out the banks. Did the banks drop the interest rate for you? Did they suspend the interest for students who couldn't pay back the loans or were finding financial difficult times? Did they help keep you in your house? No, they did not. No. If every industry that receives government subsidies, entitlements, if they were to stop giving them, most of those big corporations would go broke. So we, the people, are keeping a corporate welfare state alive and thriving. In point of fact, the four largest banks in the United States are all insolvent. They're all broke. And the only money they've been making are the hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, that they have borrowed at zero interest. We can't borrow any of that. So that's my thought on Social Security. I'll deal with Medicare and Medicaid on an upcoming program. Let's say hello to Peter from Pennsylvania. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Gary. Peter from Glen Mills, Pennsylvania. Calling you about chemtrails, also I had one other thought on that. First, my partner and I have gotten extremely sick over the last week. We are in stellar health. I've been following your protocols for years. And I talked to somebody close to you, and they said it could be TB or it could be anthrax poisoning. I'm supposed to see my holistic physician many miles from here, 3.5 hours away on Long Island, sometime coming up. But other than taking Sambucus and my regular protocol, do you have any suggestions for that? And number two, the question on the negativity that somebody approached you on the street about last week. Gee, Gary, you always report all the negative things. What do we do? Poor me, poor me. Be getting a lot of that from people that I talk with, which means that my circle is growing smaller and smaller, which is fine because a few good friends are better than a multitude of many half-friends.
Okay, let's take those in point. First, when someone suggests that they only want to hear good news, then they're in complete denial of the world we live in. Yesterday morning in Central Park, I talked for almost an hour about what is it that we're trying to do. We're trying to see the truth in our actions, in our behavior, in our relationships, in the institutions we have supported that would not exist without us. And then I asked this, how many of those institutions or relationships are actually mutually supportive in a healthy, positive, in a spiritual way where you can harmonize, where there's an effortless go forward on all things? Well, let's just take a look at the media. The media is extremely biased, and we all know that. Left is just as biased. And if you doubt me, I'll show you people on this, not the network I originate from, but on some of the some of the programs that carry us around, the stations that carry us, where if you suggested there's a problem with vaccines, they're pro-vaccine. They're pro-everything in the medical-industrial complex. They're pro the drugging of children. They're pro the psychiatric community. They have never challenged it. Why not? What would be the fear of just looking for the truth? Remember when I said that when I had all those people, 1,000, 7,000 people, once a conference and a scientific conference, I was a keynote speaker at, doing original papers, but no one followed through. Not a single person ever called me, wrote, emailed, or came to my office. We, Dr. Martin Feldman and I, invited the American public, the scientists and physicians, nurses, to attend any of the support groups to see how they're done so they can take that information back. None ever does. Why? Because of what Fritz Perl said, a fear of knowing is a fear of doing. Once you know the truth, then how can you not act upon it? It will haunt you to know the truth and not engage it. I believe we have to walk in the direction of our fears. I believe that we must engage all of our negativity. Because in life, Peter, it is not the best that you are that determines how far you go and what impact you have and what mark you leave, what legacy you live. It is the weakest, darkest elements within you that you fear to resolve and fear to deal with that will undo everything else. And therefore, the more we hide, disguise, avoid, and deny the dark side of our being, and then we hide under these concepts of social anxiety disorder or, you know, depression, it doesn't work. You have to realize these are artificial constructs and then artificially medicated so that you don't have to look at the truth that our institutions have failed us. The media lies, the commercials they give us. They'll have 20 and 30-year-old nice-looking models drinking and socializing, and suddenly we want to buy their vodka, we want to buy their gin or their rum. Well, is that going to make us better? No, it's just a bitter-tasting alcohol. No alcohol tastes good. And the reason a lot of them like gin is because they taste the lemon or lime that's put in it, and the same with vodka, and they think they're cool. Well, what do you want to bet that if I took a $3 bottle of the cheapest vodka in the world and I put it into the bottle of the most expensive vodka in the world, $1,000 a bottle, none of the idiots would know the difference. And that's the same for wine as well. But the pretense, the illusion that somehow we're sophisticated, the bouquet, the smell, it's nonsense. It's all pretense. So when you look in the mirror, if you are afraid of what you're going to see, you're going to disguise what you're going to see. You're going to put up there that our country is, mighty. Yes, it is. And what does it do with its might? Does it feed the 18 million hungry children? Does it help find work for those who want to work? No. Does it de-ghettoize the suburbs and the rural areas? No. In the urban areas? No. Does it stop its war on drugs that actually creates more crime and harm and destruction and suffering? No. It just creates more prison cells, longer prison terms, because it's profitable. When was the last time you saw a healthy food for children or babies or infants or teenagers on television? You don't, because they don't exist. The foods that are there, everyone's fully aware, cause disease. They're loaded with empty calories. They're loaded with meat. Today, the New York Times had a piece on meat in a study, and they found that a particular amino acid in the meat that is eaten can create heart disease, which means that you're more likely to have heart disease and die if you eat meat. But we've been saying this for a long time. If we had any desire to know the truth and act on it, we would have all been meatless a long time ago. But we want the illusion, not the reality. It's just too harsh for us, which means that if you can't handle the truth, you can't handle yourself, which means then that you're living a very passive existence, expecting to be taken care of. Your thoughts are to be made for you. That's why Hillary Clinton will be the next president. Any idiot could have seen that the only reason that she became Secretary of State, which was a step down from her, was so she could fill in her resume to be the president. And she will have the people lining up who will vote for her without even thinking or looking at anything that she has sponsored in the past or been a part of. That's how it works. When you're in the illusion, you also have to accept other people's illusions. If you want people to believe your lies, you have to accept their lies. That's why Chris Hedges, who I'm going to be interviewing tonight, he decided he couldn't be in any human rights organization where the head of it is a hawk who supports human rights abuses. Forget the titles. Forget what people posture. What do they actually do? What do they actually support? Let me give you an example of that, Peter. This is from Will Potter and in Terrorism Prisoners. Quote, last week, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit on behalf of multiple inmates housed in secretive prison facilities on U.S. soil called Communications Management Units. The suit is an addition to one previously filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and marks an increased pressure on the Obama administration to explain how these facilities were created, who is housed there, and why. As a quick introduction, there are two Communications Management Units, or CMUs, in the country. They radically restrict prisoner communications with the outside world that levels to levels that rival or exceed the most restrictive facilities in the country. They were opened secretly in violation of the law. These units were opened without public notification and the required comment period in violation of the Administrative Procedure Act. After similar programs were thwarted by civil rights groups, if the Obama administration feels these secretive prisons should exist, they should defend these policies and open. They are political prisons. Most prisoners in CMUs have no significant disciplinary history. Have no disciplinary history whatsoever. None of the defendants in the lawsuits have any previous violations of communication rules, yet they are being housed in a communications management unit. They are transferred without notification. The only common thread to explain why these prisoners have been moved to the CMUs is that they are individuals the government would rather keep hidden. Controversial cases, jailhouse lawyers, and prisoners such as Daniel McGowan, who have remained outspoken about their political beliefs despite being incarcerated. Inmates are transferred without an opportunity of appeal in clear violation of their due process rights. The Director of Bureau of Prisons has testified that there were 1,200 international and domestic prisoners. And these experimental facilities are cruel and inhumane. The restrictions on prisoner communications rival or exceed the worst that there is. The extreme restrictions on inmate communications, including not allowing them to hug family members at the few visits they are allowed, go against a body of research and official government policy on prisoner treatment. And they mark a continuation of the Guantanamo mindset by the Obama administration. Now, here's the issue, Peter, and this ties in with what you were suggesting. Here we have something that the media will not touch, that the Democrats, corporate Democrats, and the corporate liberals will never speak about, that we have secret prisons where people who are political prisoners. We're not supposed to have ever any political prisoners in the United States, yet these are all for political prisoners. Other countries arrest people who they don't like, who are popular or outspoken, and put them in political prisons. Iran, Egypt, Israel, all over the world. South Africa, irony of ironies, isn't it? And the new apartheid going on there. So what you have is you have secrecy from the public, and they're getting away with it because the Attorney General is accepting it, and they know that no one's going to complain except those who are either in prison or those who are never allowed to form in the media. So the people who know the truth, the people who know the failure of our educational institutions, which are being privatized, curriculums altered to profit the corporations that make the curriculums, the charter schools, the other schools, the public schools being closed, teachers who could teach fired, is for profit. It has nothing to do with empowering students to be able to live better in the world by knowing what should be taught to them and critical thinking. Our entire medical industrial complex is based upon profit, not curing patients. We don't cure patients. We maintain disease status on rigid protocols that were written by the pharmaceutical industry and then made mandatory through state medical boards and through the control they have over the insurance industry, working hand in glove with the medical industrial complex. So you're paid for certain administrative processes and procedures and drugs and not for others. And where is this exposed? Why don't we look at all the war on cancer money and researchers and doctors and patients who have died, tens of millions, and exactly what have we learned? Nothing. But we don't pay people for curing. We pay people for treatment. So we want to reward effort, not results. And that's true of every institution. Our banking institutions are too big to fail and too big to prosecute. And they're getting bigger. And so what do? We continue with a fraudulent Federal Reserve to give me more. So when I say that every institution has betrayed us, all of our leaders have betrayed us, all politicians have betrayed us, with few exceptions, that's what I mean. So exactly where are you going to see the truth and be able to at least accept that you want to deal with it or you don't want to deal with it? If you want to continue eating your pizzas, hot dogs, hamburgers, drinking, smoking, and think somehow you're going to dodge the bullet, you won't. You just don't know when it's going to hit you in the head with a heart attack or a stroke or cancer or pain. But the person that wants the truth can then act on it. So don't look at bad news as the end of anything. Look at bad news as the breakdown of an old belief system that allows you the beginning of a new system. Transforming your life, transforming your crisis, transforming your fear into something more wholesome. Hope that answers your question, Peter. Let's say hello to Pamora from Florida. Hi, Pamora.
Hi, Mr. Null. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you.
I'm calling from Jacksonville, Florida. First, let me say I love you. And the vegan chef classes with Shelly is a great idea. I want in whenever that starts.
Good.
The reason I called today is I wanted to know, can you suggest an education program or do you offer a training course that will allow the people that know the truth to, assist them to be able to help and heal and teach this holistic way of life to other people?
I've been thinking about that, and I've come up with an idea. I'll just tell you the brief outline. I'm thinking of starting what would be called Socrates Garden, meaning bringing together some of the finest minds from around the world and put them over the internet, a small place, a beautiful environment where they would be, and give them maybe 2 days each, about 4 hours a day. And the first 2 hours, they're talking about an issue. The last 2 hours, people could email in and text in their questions and issues that would be addressed. Discreetly placed cameras so they could get up and walk around and talk as if they were out, like Socrates in a garden. And that is the idea. I'm looking at actually, now that I've come up with the idea, once the idea percolates and I know it can happen, I'll start to work on it. So sometime in the near future, this actually will happen. Okay?
Okay.
All the best to you.
Thank you, and keep me posted.
I will. Thank you, Pamora. And let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, here's a piece of news that just came to me. Just as you called it, this was going to happen, and I've not heard the media talk about Fukushima for a long time. There's a nuclear plant leaking contaminated water in Japan, and they're talking about tons of highly radioactive water is going from a temporary storage tank, and it's leaking all over the place. So we're not hearing about this. We need to know about this, and people are asking, what do you think, how do you think that's going to impact the economy and or the United States?
It won't, but what will happen is, depending upon what is in the radioactive water, radiation, these radioisotopes, they're going to go right through everything. They'll go through mud, rock, sand, and they'll go into the lower aquifers, and there are two major aquifers underneath Fukushima. And that means it'll go into the aquifer system that is used for irrigating their rice crops. So the likelihood is they'll try to cover this up. They'll try to take samples of rice from areas they know would not be fed by that aquifer. But they did this earlier this year. They would go into a community. They would take some shovels. They would dig down about a foot They would clean off all the soil for about 15 feet. They would then do a reading on just that specific spot and say, oh, this is within normal range. The camera wouldn't see that if they moved it 5 feet away, it would be high again. The Japanese government is so corrupt. It's just pathologically dysfunctional. The trouble is you have a Japanese public that is so trusting of authority that only the most, let's say, independent thinking one will challenge any of this. People will not move if they're told not to. They'll eat the food if they're told to eat the food. If they're told it's safe, they'll drink the water. And the government will continue to play this down because once you pollute an aquifer with radiation, you cannot depollute it. So sooner or later, the reality will happen, probably a year to two from now, when vast amounts of Japan's water system will be shown to be forever polluted. That's all the time we have. I want to thank everyone for listening and calling in. But we will take... No, I'm looking at the clock. I don't want to take any more. I look forward to the runners and walkers, only people from the Running and Walking Club, for the private screening tonight of the new film. And please tune in tonight at 7 o'clock. You won't want to miss this discussion on the end of our culture with two of the finest intellects in the world today. Have a nice day, everyone.
Say it's all right.
It's all right.